hate you both. I've hated you ever since I can remember. I hate you, and I wish you both had cancer.
Cancer?
Yes, in the head.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Are you telling me you built a time machine? Out of a DeLorean?
This is the Stupid Cancer Show.
Uh-oh. Sounds like somebody's got a case of the Mondays.
Hello there, children!
Hey, hey, kids!
People seem to like me because I am polite and I'm rarely late.
Don't worry, I got an idea.
And now, the host of the Stupid Cancer Show, Matthew Zach.
Woohoo!
Not that there's anything wrong with us.
Because he has a lot of chutzpah.
All right.
Hello and welcome to episode 388 of the Stupid Cancer Show, the voice of young adult cancer. I'm your host, Matthew Zachary, a proud 20-year young adult brain cancer survivor coming to you now from the Chemo Deck, our fabulous studio in downtown Manhattan. Broadcasting since 2007, the Stupid Cancer Show is a production of Stupid Cancer, the largest charity comprehensively addressing young adult cancer, online at stupidcancer.org.
I'm Mallory Rivera, program manager and co-producer of The Stupid Cancer Show, welcoming all our first-time and returning listeners. Never miss an episode by subscribing to the podcast on iTunes and following us on SoundCloud.
It is not okay that 72,000 young adults are diagnosed with cancer each and every year. So, got cancer? Under 40? Sucks, huh? Time to get busy living, folks, because the Stupid Cancer Show is changing the world one chemo infusion at a time. We got a great show, Stupid Risk, a cancer in the family. Dr. Theodora Ross is a leading researcher on cancer susceptibility genes, as well as a practitioner who specialized in treating breast cancer for more than a decade. She now cares for all types of patients who have a family history of cancer and is also a carrier of a cancer-causing mutation and a young adult survivor of melanoma herself. Dr. Ross joins us to discuss her book, A Cancer in the Family, which mixes memoir with science, and our survivor spotlight on young adult breast cancer fighter, Katie Campbell. It's going to be a great show. Hello, Mallory and Noel.
Hello.
How are you?
Oh, you know. Just ducky.
On this fabulous... You haven't seen Hamilton yet, have you?
I certainly have not.
No.
It's a sore point, but I did maybe stay up until way too late trying to find all of the clips of Hamilton winning all of the things.
Yeah, he did a really good job at the awards.
They were all phenomenal. The entire award, Tony Awards. The Tonys, for those who are not theater geeks like myself. It was pretty phenomenal. All of the feelings and yes. The Hamilton.
Yes, good stuff. All good stuff. So this show is about risk, and I figured I just might as well ask you guys at the top of the show. would you get all right? So A, you're here. You work at a cancer group. B, thankfully, knock wood, you have not had cancer personally. Would you ever want to get just screened, checked, sequenced to see what your or is ignorance bliss or just wait and see?
Genetic testing.
Yeah. I'm just curious.
I mean, personally speaking, I coincidentally, before we even spoke of that, this was looking up genetic testing a month or two back.
And oh, yeah?
So I guess that speaks in and of itself that I'd be interested.
Yeah?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't really prescribe to the ignorance is bliss thing, but yeah.
Yeah, I actually agree with that sentiment. I have a interesting history family-wise, so I would get screened, absolutely.
Yeah.
Sometimes knowing and being prepared and knowing the things helps.
Yeah, because we're going to talk about that on the show today. Our guest, Dr. Theodora Ross, her whole family had cancer and she worked in risk and still didn't get tested herself.
Yeah, until...
Until she had cancer herself.
It's a fascinating story.
Yeah.
And it's a fascinating book that she's written as well.
There's an organization called 23andMe which was founded by, I think it's Sergey Brin's wife of Google, and a woman named Linda Avey. And it's like basically at Walgreens now. You can spend $100 and get a spit kit, and they send your DNA off to the world of fabulous science and discovery. And they come back to you with a chart as to how you are you. They don't go into cancer risk because that's kind of crazy serious, but it's simple things like, oh, you shouldn't eat beets.
Yeah.
Or caffeine only works well on you if you have it at night.
I think it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
Especially the caffeine bit. How fast does your body metabolize caffeine?
Yes. No, it's fascinating. And our chairman emeritus, Dr. Leonard Sender, years ago, he was one of the first. Of course he was one of the first out of the gate to get the test. And he confirmed what he always suspected his whole life. He is immune to caffeine.
Yeah.
Immune to caffeine.
It's definitely, yeah. it's interesting because
I would kill myself.
It's interesting to know what makes you on a,
yeah,
on a biological basis.
It's pretty crazy.
But it is. Pretty intense.
Well, that weight loss thing that I did this January went a very similar thing. They do a spit test and they sequence your genes and they decide what nutrients your body does and does not process well compared to combining with other nutrients. So you shouldn't have these vegetables and you shouldn't have these fruits, but you should eat these volumes and quantities of things, not together, but yes, together. And these cheeses are not good. It's amazing.
Yeah, if you look at it from a very scientific standpoint, it makes sense. If we all have slightly different breakdowns, that different breakdowns would better support our body of different things.
Yeah, and the same science says that once you've hit your weight by 45, don't even try to lose or gain anymore. That's your body. Yeah. Your body's your body at 45.
Your body is your body, and there's only so much you could do about it.
Yeah, by 45. Yeah, I got 3 more years to go. So we got a good show. Nothing really huge in the news. There was that really nice story you posted on Friday about that that young man and
yes,
the prom.
Who took his mother to the prom.
Yes.
Very sweet 17-year-old gentleman.
Tough.
That is a gentleman right there.
Yeah. I mean, it also speaks to how we're looking to reach teenagers whose moms and dads are sick as well.
Yeah.
And we want to be that community for anyone that's young, touched by cancer. So we got to find that kid and get him on the show.
I'm
and
on
his
it.
Mom. You're on it?
I'm on it.
All right, make it happen. All right, well, let's kick off the show. Let's get Katie. In our spotlight, Katie Campbell, 32-year-old, been living with stage 4 triple-negative breast cancer for the last 3 years. She's an advocate, speaker, and author of a forthcoming book about her experiences. Please welcome to share her story, the one, the only, Katie Campbell. Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much.
The issues... this particular show is about risk, hereditary risk, genetic screening, preventative care, prophylactic mastectomies, pretty much everything that, you know, is annoying when you're a young person because it factors into everything else. And
yeah.
Then we yell at our moms and grandmas for having breast cancer and not telling us to get screened. So there you go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you not only combine metastatic cancer, it is the triple negative cancer as well, which is a another sub-genetic thing of breast cancer, which doesn't get a lot of attention, and that we know all too well because of Annie Goodman, our late friend here at the podcast. So story, it's so important that these stories of living with cancer or metastatic cancer get told, because they tend to fall by the wayside when all the pink ribbon nonsense says otherwise. And I know we both have a mutual hatred of all that pink washing.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I think stage 4 cancer stories are left out of the pink washing. I think triple negative stories are left out. And I think young adults are in many ways left out. So yeah, I have lots of feelings about October in general.
Yes, exactly. Well, you're no stranger to being the consummate young adult cancer advocate and survivor. You've been to First Ascent. You've come to CancerCon. You won the Outliving It Award, which I didn't realize I had, but that's super cool. So congratulations on that. And
thank you.
And, you know, you're writing this. I mean, I've been watching you on Facebook, this book. You've been fundraising for it. It looks incredibly exciting. I want to talk to you about it. But let's start at the beginning here. You know, how how does someone get diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer?
I found a lump. Obviously, I was 30 years old, so I was not obviously at the point where I needed to be screened or anything, getting mammograms. I found a lump, went to my doctor. I feel kind of lucky in that it all seemed to happen pretty quickly, unlike, you know, you hear the stories about misdiagnoses and doctors not believing young adults. But, you know, biopsy, mammogram, ultrasound, all of that, like, in one day. And, like, 4 days later, I got my diagnosis in September of 2013. They told me it was triple negative. I was like, I have no idea what that means.
Exactly.
Sounds triply bad somehow. But it took me a couple months to realize that triple negative breast cancer, you know, much more aggressive, tends to be harder to treat, you know, comes with a lower survival, rate of survival, all of that stuff. So, but I was kind of put through the normal course of treatment that everybody else goes through. But for me, it didn't really work. So I had 20 rounds of chemo over 9 months. And the chemo never really had any impact on the cancer, which was a bummer having to go through that and not seeing any results. And then double mastectomy. And speaking of prophylactic mastectomies, for triple negative breast cancer, there was actually an improvement in survival rate. So, to get the double mastectomy. So that's why I did that. And then I had radiation. And then like 3 months later, the cancer was back in a distant lymph node, making it stage 4. And I've been dealing with that ever since. So
a lot of things there to talk about. I mean, just from a completely superficial perspective, I'm amazed that you went from diagnosis to treatment so quickly. And that this is a kind of a silent disease. How could you possibly know that this was lurking in your body and all of a sudden, boom, stage 4?
Yeah. It's really scary. And I had actually, that summer that I was, before I was diagnosed, I was like, oh, I'm turning 30. I should like maybe have a primary care physician, like maybe like think about my health for, you know, 10 seconds. Like let's focus on it a little bit. So I was going around seeing primary care physicians and got, you know, breast exams and at every doctor I saw until I found one that I liked, and nobody felt anything. Like it was, and then like a month later it was a golf ball sized tumor. So it kind of came out of nowhere. Which I think just shows how aggressive this thing is, right. Unfortunately.
No. And again, just to kind of crush the trolls that stalk our Facebook pages, you were vegan and are vegan and in health and in shape and just doing your thing, and it's totally irrelevant.
No, I was vegan. I was super, you know, like super athletic, exercise all the time. Speaking of genes, like I don't really have a family history. I don't have any of the genes. You know, they've tested like 30 or something at this point, and I don't have any of them, so no warning signs, you know, nothing.
So you are currently married. Were you married when you were diagnosed?
Yes. Yep.
So can you talk us through that?
What it was like, it's been like.
Yeah, we have a lot of couples, and we have stories of couples that had just moved in together to become domestically compatible, and then cancer hits before anything else happens. Yeah. Your husband sounds like a champion. Can you talk us through what it was like for him and how he's managing now?
Yeah. I actually devote an entire chapter to this in the book because I think it's so important. I think relationships are such an important part of young adult cancer journeys. But my husband has been fantastic. Like he was, for better or worse, he was in grad school when I was diagnosed. We'd been married for 5 or 6 years at that point. And he was in grad school, so his schedule is flexible. He was able to come with me to my chemo you know, my infusions. He came with me to almost every doctor's appointment in that first year, which is incredible. But it took a toll. I mean, it was hard. I think the transition from husband-wife to caregiver-patient, and we always joke that, like, he has a really high tolerance for pain, and I really love, like, feeding people chicken soup. So, like, obviously our role should have been reversed.
Right.
Like, I mean, I would never wish cancer on him, but, like, you know, I'm the caregiver, and he had to kind of figure out what that role looked like for him. So it's been a struggle, but I think at this point, and then being stage four, you know, like that, obviously lots of discussions about and just concerns about what's the rest of our life look like, you know, what happens if you have to go on without me, what does that look like? And just, I think at this point we have reached the point where we just try to sort of treasure the moments that we have together. Like, even small insignificant things are really important to us, and we don't take anything for granted, I think. So, yeah, I feel super lucky to have him, though.
And this is all so true and so real. You did come to CancerCon 2015, our inaugural conference in Denver. Did your husband come, or what was the experience like for you?
Yeah, he came. Yeah, it was great. I think it was really wonderful to, that was like the first opportunity I had to really bring him into the young adult cancer world. And I think it was just really nice for him to be able to connect with other caregivers, and for him to see kind of the power of the young adult cancer movement and how many resources are out there, and just how many great folks are part of it. So it was a great, we both really loved it. Yeah, it was excellent.
And First Ascents is an amazing organization that does adventure retreats for young adults with cancer. What is your First Ascents nickname?
Crush. I'm Crush.
Why is that?
The day I was diagnosed, I sent out an email. So I have like a sort of not-so-secret obsession with alliteration. So the day I was diagnosed, I sent out an email and invited everyone to Team Katie Crushes Cancer. And then just Crushes Cancer kind of became my thing, and my friends started calling me Crush. So I went into First Ascents already with a cancer nickname.
I'm trying to invent something alliterative now, and I just can't, but I will do my best over the course of the remaining interview. I want to talk about your choices, you know, living your life right now, you know, putting pen to paper, so to speak. You are you were very passionate online, using Kickstarter to come up with the money to fund this book called The Courage Club, A Radical Guide to Audacity, Living Beyond Cancer. True words have never been said. What has motivated you to take that leap into literature?
So I've kept a blog through my whole journey, and it was really just, it was more a space for myself, you know, just like get out whatever crazy emotion I was feeling at the time. It was a helpful place to get my friends and family to understand what I was going through, all of that stuff. Great place. It just a good place to sort of document what was going on. And I know tons of young adults have keep cancer blogs. I think it's a great tool. But the book was kind of me trying to pivot from writing just for myself to writing to try to help serve the broader young adult cancer community. So, you know, I'm sort of writing for that person who is maybe going through treatments now, or maybe just finished treatments, and it just feels so shitty. You know, like you feel like your life has been torn open. You feel like you've lost all of these, maybe you've lost relationships, or you've lost your career trajectory, or the ability to become a mother, which was so hard for me to handle. So, you know, there's so much loss. And yet at the same time, like, our lives, we know that we can't take our lives for granted. Our lives might be shorter than we wanted. They might, you know, cancer sort of threatens that. So how do we make the most out of the time we have left after having gone through such difficult crisis and trauma and all of that? So that is kind of what the book is about, and why I decided to write it. Yeah, and the Kickstarter's just been crazy.
So it,
I don't know if you want me.
What would be your, I guess, like, so I'm rhetorically newly diagnosed. I find your book. I'm scared out of my mind. What are some of the things I could learn from reading your book? What do you hope to impart to the next you?
You know, I think a lot of it is about, trying to be sort of gentle and kind and compassionate with yourself. Cancer really does have a way, and cancer treatments have a way of just kind of beating us up and spitting us out the other side. And it's easy to feel like we're going crazy. It's easy to feel overwhelmed by the emotions that come along with all of that. So a big part of it is give yourself a break, because you totally deserve one. But it's also about connecting. Like, I think I came out of my first year of treatment feeling just disconnected from myself, from my friends, from the world around me. And so a lot of it is like, how do we connect to, like, how can, you know, going camping for a weekend, connecting to nature, kind of the idea of first ascent, like, how can that help us get through? How can connecting to something like food, like what we're eating? You know, I think a lot of cancer patients become like afraid of food. Like, am I allowed to eat sugar? Am I allowed to, should I be eating meat or not, or what, you know? So just like connecting to ourselves and the world around us is kind of a big part of the message.
So let's talk a little bit about, and I don't want to just like have it be this glanced over comment. You can't be a mom, and fertility over the course of the last 10 years, people ask me, well, why young adults? And the one answer that just not shuts them up, because that sounds mean, but that helps them wrap their head around why we're uniquely age specific is parenting. The civil liberty to be a mom or a dad, to have as many kids as you so please, is taken away from you in many, many cases. And in the cases it doesn't have to be, you're still not made aware of that risk to begin with.
Yeah. I was actually one of the lucky ones, I feel like, early on, because they basically said to me, they were like, handed me my diagnosis, and then they said, what are your priorities? Which I thought was kind of a weird question to ask a newly diagnosed patient, but immediately I was like, you can take my boobs. I don't care about them, but I want to keep my fertility, whatever I have to do. And like, I only knew that I should say that because I'd like Googled it that weekend, you know, and found out that chemo can take your fertility. Otherwise I just had no knowledge. So I have embryos frozen. I call them my space babies because it just feels like some weird space age technology.
Space babies.
But lots of other, you know, at this point, I'm on treatments all the time. I don't know if I'll ever be off them. I don't know if I'll ever get to a point. My cancer is not stable. It continues to progress. So, you know, I don't know if that I'll ever get to a point where my cancer was stable enough that I would feel safe enough to say, okay, let's, you know, start a family. Really anything that requires looking more than 3 months in the future is just tough, I think, for a lot of stage 4 cancer patients. But losing the ability to become a mother, I think is probably the most devastating part of this whole journey for me. Cause that was it for me. Like my mom was a midwife when I was growing up. I was surrounded by babies. Like that's all I cared about. That's all I wanted to do when I got older. And we were actually planning to start a family or trying for a family the month that I got diagnosed. So just one of those things.
With a few, just a minute or so left, I mean, this episode we started out is about risk. We're going to be speaking with a notable cancer researcher on risk and a young adult survivor herself whose sister had breast cancer, her mother had breast cancer. Do you have siblings, or is there a way to figure out how this might be hereditary in the other parts of your family, per se?
I have a younger brother, but no, like I said, I haven't yet tested positive for any known cancer, you know, genes that are connected to cancer. So But I mean, I know this is like a little bit out of the box of the idea that you're covering, but we're all at risk for cancer.
Yes.
And I'm like a huge proponent among my family, friends, and everybody about, you know, doing everything that you can to prevent cancer just through, you know, lifestyle choices and things like that. So that's really where the conversation is for me, because I don't have like a specific thing to point to for my family to get tested or, you know, anything like that.
Right. Well, Katie Campbell, living with stage 4 triple negative breast cancer, stage 30, she's 32 years old now. Her forthcoming book, The Courage Club, A Radical Guide to Audacity to Living Beyond Cancer. What is the website where people can learn more about the book?
So right now it's, like I said, it's up on Kickstarter. So you can, if you just search Courage Club and Kickstarter, you'll find it. Or you can go to bit.ly/ Courage Club Kickstarter. Or you can go to katieacampbell.com and you'll find stuff there as well.
Katie, thank you. God bless. And hopefully we'll see you again very soon.
Thanks so much, Matt. I really appreciate it. Take
okay.
care.
Katie Campbell, everyone. All right, and now the news.
Hello, I'm Kent Brockman, and this is Eye on Cancer.
Just the facts, ma'am.
Head on over to events.stupidcancer.org. That's events.stupidcancer.org. Sign up for meetup alerts and never miss a meetup again. If you'd like to learn more about hosting your own stupid cancer meetup, visit stupidcancer.org/meetup. Okay, there are events happening in New York, Baltimore, Chapel Hill, West Chicago, Cherry Hill, and San Diego.
No one should face cancer alone because isolation sucks. Now you can get instant anonymous peer support on your mobile device with InstaPeer, our free mobile app for iOS and Android devices. Create your account and privately message with fellow patients, survivors, and caregivers who have been there and walked in your shoes. Join our mobile community of thousands right now on your mobile device, InstaPeer.
We've launched a newsfeed aggregator on Tumblr for all the articles, blogs, and stories we couldn't possibly have the time to post on social media. Check out what we're reading 24/7 and don't miss a beat. Subscribe at stupidcancer.org/feed.
If you've not yet checked out the Stupid Cancer Community Forums, you are missing out. Join thousands of your peers in a safe and meaningful environment to get connected and swap stories, to learn from one another and foster the young adult cancer conversation. With hundreds of topics, discussion groups, and issues to choose, it is a great place to get busy living. Learn more at stupidcancer.org/community.
Support our programs and services by heading over to stupidcancerstore.org. You'll feel great and look great in your new Stupid Cancer gear. That's stupidcancerstore.org. Be proud. Wear Stupid Cancer.
And that's your Stupid Cancer News. Oncologist and cancer gene hunter Theodore Ross has written a comprehensive and authoritative go-to for people facing genetic predisposition for cancer. The book is called A Cancer in the Family, with a foreword by Siddhartha Mukherjee, one of my all-time besties, author of The Emperor of All Maladies. Please welcome to the show, Dr. Theodore Ross. Welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you.
Hi, Matthew.
Yes, wonderful, wonderful. This is a very, very relevant topic to our audience, the young adult cancer community. Risk, risk management, risk reduction. We often take some challenge with the word prevention, and mm-hmm. screenings are a factor here, and, you know, hereditary risk, and we're such a small percentage to begin with, but disproportionately at genetic predisposition to cancer. And I listened to your interview with Terry Gross on NPR. Fascinating. And I'm excited to be speaking with you about how all of this incredible science is becoming applicable in the real world, and mm-hmm. how academia is building a bridge to the average patient with regard to it.
Well, especially in the situation of stupid cancer. You know, people who have cancer before the age of 39... genetics.
Yeah,
it's like saying plastics. It's genetics.
It's your and what control can you have? I mean, I was born with brain cancer. It was congenital in utero, and it presented when I was 21 years old, but it sat in my head the whole time. You know, our first guest on the show here was diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer, stage 4, at the age of 30, vegetarian, vegan, actually, athlete, rock climber, perfect health. You know, you're looking at 80,000 people getting cancer every year under 40 years old. Is it all just bad luck because of your genes?
Depending on the cancer, the chances are pretty good. So when you have one gene mutated and you've got two copies of your genes, when you have one gene mutated, you've got a head start. And so cancer happens earlier. So in terms of the first guest, the genetic predisposition to breast cancer is pretty likely.
So you talked a lot about, you know, how, you know, genes can turn good cells into bad cells. What role, and this may be a stretch here, that there are certain things you can and can't control in life. You can control what you eat, how you move. You really can't control what you breathe or, you know, the soil or things like that. Have you done any thought-provoking insight into the sort of the extramural activities that can contribute to the triggers of genetic mutation?
Well, when you say genetic mutations, we're talking we've got inherited versus the genes are mutated somatically. And in terms of inherited mutations, there's really nothing you can do because who your daddy is who your daddy is. Same with your mom. What you can do about that, if you know that you have that, so for example, if the first guest on the show were to know that she had a mutation in one of the breast cancer causing genes, whether it's CHEK2 or BRCA1 or BRCA2, et cetera, then you can do something about that by taking greater surveillance, watching the organs at risk, or even more aggressively removing them. So prophylactic surgeries. I don't know. I unfortunately didn't hear that first part, but I will tomorrow. Whether or not she had both of her breasts removed, and does she know whether or not she has a mutation?
Yeah, she does know that she has the triple negative mutation, not BRCA, and she had a prophylactic bilateral mastectomy, but she did not have an oophorectomy yet. And she's.
But what mutation did she have then?
Oh, I would have to go back and listen to
I had a BRCA1 mutation, so I'm really open about that, as you know.
Well, and your story is fascinating because you were pretty much surrounded by cancer in your whole family, and then you yourself was diagnosed with melanoma as a younger person, and then all of a sudden, wow. So the question is, do you really have to have a point of entry of diagnosis to get risk assessment?
No. I mean, I think looking into your family history is really important. There are some people who don't have that. Some people have very small families. Some people were adopted, et cetera. But if you've got a large enough family and you have signs in your family, positive signs. So in my family, almost all my siblings had young adult cancers. So I had a sister with breast cancer in her 30s, a brother with testicular cancer in his 20s, and so at that point, there was enough of a sign that if I had been a smart person instead of a stupid person, I would have said, wow, that's really significant. We might want to look into the genetics here. But I was a little bit in denial.
Well, and that's a great word because, younger people aren't typically predisposed to mortality or vulnerability.
Yes.
You're at a point.
They're immortal.
Well, you're supposed to be, right? I mean, why wouldn't you? What's the point of being 19 and jumping off roofs if you don't feel immortal?
Exactly. You should be able to be immortal. But unfortunately, we're not all immortal.
No.
So, that truthiness, as Colbert would say,
truthiness,
only takes you so far.
So where is the reality check in your perspective on... So I think we're both Jewish. In Yiddish, we say the sechel, the wherewithal, the preemptive, interest in understanding risk. Where could that possibly hit you in your life to say, I should get screened out of nowhere?
Well, obviously, if you have a family history like the one I describe for myself, then, I don't think it is right that I just denied the whole thing. I think it's really important to say, wow, is there something I can do about this? And there's a lot of help. You can talk to a genetic counselor. They're all over the place. You can, I have a book I just published. You can read that. But really, the reality is, if you've got a family history of diseases where there may be something you can do about it to prolong your life, I beg people to not do what I did.
Well, yeah, and again, like we're looking at how young adult cancer is now biologically, it's been shown in the literature and epidemiology,
yeah.
It's a biologically different type of cancer than the same cancer in someone that presents in their mature years, over 50,
yes.
55, 60 years old.
Yes, they are totally, yeah, like everybody says, there's many, many cancers, many, many diseases. And when it's in young people, it's a different disease, but it's also potentially has a genetic component. And if you have a genetic component, you can be the leader in your family. You can discover that you have a mutation, then other people in your family can be tested, and you can save lives, not just your own.
So where would that conversation start? I'm diagnosed with cancer. How would I have any idea what even any of this means if I'm just walking in the door and everything's Charlie Brown teacher? Is it the physician's responsibility to talk about risk and genetics?
Well, you know, the problem with that we're running into right now is, yes, ultimately it is the physician's responsibility to say, hey, you know, you're a young person with cancer. Let's look at your family history. Maybe you do have a genetic predisposition. Let's have you see our local genetic counselor. They take a stronger family history, then they test you for a gene. That's the ideal sequence of events. Unfortunately, in medical school, we don't get trained this way. We don't have genetic training. We have, you know, maybe a couple of classes. Hopefully that's going to change as genetics has gotten more and more complex. We've sequenced genomes. We're discovering more and more genes. And so I think it's going to change, but there's not as much knowledge in your physicians as you would think about this. I mean, myself, I wasn't educated enough to know. Back when I was thinking about it, I was only thinking about BRCA1 and BRCA2. Now we're testing for 30 genes on panels, 40 genes. Physicians just don't know. And so it is partly your responsibility to be in the know, to be part of Stupid Cancer, and Stupid Cancer can put on their website, if you're young and you have cancer, maybe you want to think about a genetic predisposition. But there are multiple ways to get to know this. But this is information. This is knowledge that hasn't been transmitted yet. So now, awareness is kind of there, but knowledge is not.
Well, I couldn't agree more with that. You were actually a trendsetter. You know, 12 years ago, you had a prophylactic bilateral mastectomy way before Angelina Jolie made it famous.
Thank God she did it, though. I mean, she's an example of getting people aware. You know, physicians can't do what she did. She used her, you know, beautifulness and her stardom to change the world.
No, and it made a real difference. I'm actually curious if you have any data to suggest that there have been more prophylactic mastectomies because of the awareness of genetic risk because of that.
Yes, for sure. Yes. We call it the Jolie effect.
Oh, really? That's pretty cool.
Yes. Yes, it's been published.
So we have a running joke, which is, you know, kind of like the sick cancer humor that only exists in our space.
Yeah.
Around how many body parts can you live without to reduce your risk of getting cancer?
Well, true, yes. It's a good question. It's a good question. You can get rid of a lot of them. A lot of them.
So what was first of all, how did you get into this? This is a very nuanced emerging science that is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
like you said, the awareness is there, but the knowledge isn't. How did
right.
you get into this, and what are your hopes to get this into more of the mind's eye of the public?
Okay. How did I get into it? Well, it's really interesting. So I had been working at the University of Michigan for 12 years. I had a basic science lab. I was seeing breast cancer patients and had always wanted to work on BRCA1 and BRCA2 and wanted to be more into cancer genetics, but I never really had the opportunity, you know, whether it was a grant issue or whatever. So then when we moved to Dallas, where I live now, at UT Southwestern, I was given the opportunity to run their cancer genetics program. And when I got to Dallas and I had to run the cancer genetics program, I realized I didn't know anything about cancer genetics. And so I figured one way to learn about cancer genetics is to write a book. And so I started writing it sort of as a text to just learn and teach myself, and realized how complicated it was and how more complicated it was getting. And also, we sequenced a bunch of patients from our cancer genetics program. We sequenced their whole genome. And from that, I learned a ton. I learned about how complicated it is, and that, like you said, there's awareness and there's knowledge. And we're aware we can sequence a genome, but we are at the before preschool level when it comes to understanding it. So that's how I got into it. What was the second part of the question?
What is, outside of conversations with the public and with medical mm-hmm. education, how can this get trickled down to patient decision-making?
Mm. I think we just got to keep hammering away. I hope that I can, you know, get my book to the people that need it, people who are young people with cancer, or people with family histories of cancer, people who are worried that they might have a genetic syndrome. Hopefully, you know, people who do genetic testing will realize it's not just the test that matters, but it's making sure the patients are seeing counselors who can educate them. The genetic counselors are manna from heaven. They're amazing. They will, you know, take you through each step. They will take you through your family history. They'll verify your family history. They'll call hospitals to get, you know, figure out whether that ovarian cancer was a cervical cancer rather than ovarian cancer, that kind of thing. They'll help you talk to your family. So I think one of the portals is the counselor. Other portal is just continuing to talk about it, like putting it on. Yeah, I'm really hoping, you know, in terms of stupid cancer, you guys will talk more about genetics.
Oh, and we do. It's a significant issue, and you're talking about, I mean, we are not, as of right now, our larger community is, they're already done. Like, they've already had cancer.
Yeah.
They're either in treatment now.
Yeah.
The opportunities are now, how can I be smart about, you know, making my siblings know or whatever that is now. So, like, they're already drinking the Kool-Aid. We're talking, like, how do we get the uninitiated to be aware of this? There was a very sobering blog piece out of Macmillan last year. I'm going to do a terrible job botching it, but it talked about how cancer is really mm-hmm. a combination of environment, genetics, and bad luck. And
yes.
It's a tough pill to swallow when we're pushed cure every single day. How do you reconcile that? Because I have a problem doing that.
Reconciling that.
If cancer is all bad luck, what is cure?
Oh, well, we want to prevent it from happening. Right?
Well, what would that look like, let's say, in the rarer cancers in the young adult community? How would this young woman have, like, could you one day maybe walk into Duane Reade and get a cancer screening, you know, spit test? And
well,
could, you know,
right, yes. So the ideal situation with her would be that she would have known long before she got her cancer that she had this predisposition. And then with that, she would have had the opportunity to take actions to prevent it from happening to her.
So I'm fascinated by this line of thinking because it sounds very Star Trek. How far away are we from that actually being a pragmatic thing, and where would that intervention have to happen at what point in your life to get mm-hmm. that risk assessment?
Well, how old is she?
She's 32 now. She was 30 when she was diagnosed.
Yeah. So we test our patients when, you know, it comes to these mutations that predispose patients to breast cancer at that early of an age. We start screening our patients at 25, 20. We even offer prophylactic surgeries at that point. So it's there for some things. Now, here's a good way to think about it. There's this retrospective kind of perspective one can have. So we discovered BRCA1 and BRCA2 as genes that predispose people to these hereditary breast and ovarian cancer syndromes, and we discovered these in the mid-90s. And at the time, when we would say, oh, gosh, that patient probably has one of those mutations, we'd say, why would we test them? We don't know what to do. We'd have nothing to do. Now, 20 years later, we know exactly what to do, and we can prevent cancer in these patients. So it took 20 years to figure out the answer, like how would this all work? And that's the question you're asking.
Yes.
So I think it takes time. Each gene that we discovered that truly, when broken, leads to a predisposition syndrome to a particular type of cancer or to another kind of disease, once we discover that gene, then I think it'll take 10, 20 years before we figure out what the next step is to prevent the disease. And of course, there's all this new gene therapy stuff, which is a potential. It's an idea. Whether it's good or bad, we don't know. But well, something will happen. There's always progress, but it takes about 20 years to really answer that question.
No, and I completely agree with everything that you're saying. I'm just fascinated with I look at like the 23andMe, you know, test, which is has become very cheap and very consumer focused on, you know, oh, I'm allergic to caffeine or I shouldn't eat beets, mm-hmm. or, you know, whatever that is now. Mm-hmm. Is mm-hmm. it possible that there is a version of that one day that, you know, you'll be able to just get over the counter at any age? But that also is exciting from a invincibility perspective. Would a teenager ever want to know their cancer mm-hmm. risk, and how would you make that happen? It's an interesting conversation.
Would that ever happen? Will there be an over-the-counter test, genetic test, where you'd just be able to test every one of our genes and all the intervening sequences? You're basically saying a whole genome. You know, it's so complicated, I just don't see that ever happening. I still think it's going to be in the realm of medicine where we may test people. You know, the doctor may get a genome on you, and that may be part of your medical record. There may be genes in there that we'll figure out have a mutation that could predispose you to something. But I don't think it's going to be over the counter and you'll just get it in the, you know, the teenager. And then I think instead the clinical data will dictate when the doctor says you need to worry about X, Y, or Z.
All right, I'm going to come out to Texas and we're going to write a sci-fi screenplay.
Okay.
That's our date. We're writing a movie.
Yeah.
Okay, we're gonna build the future in film.
Perfect.
Except for Jews, because people like us were just screwed genetically anyway, so this is everyone else. So let's talk about the book. We have a few minutes left.
Sure.
Cancer in the Family. Sid, I know Sid like I know him, Sid. I'm in awe of him.
Yeah.
I've met him several times. The book, it really changed a lot.
What
is the purpose and the goal of the book, and what are you hoping people get out of it?
Well, the book is for people who are interested in cancer genetics, people who are worried that they might have a cancer genetic syndrome. It starts out with just saying, you know, listen, I had this experience myself. I'm going to share it with you, and maybe it'll help you get the courage to think about this, get a genetic analysis, take actions. I hope that the book will educate people, like we talked about earlier, about this, not just patients, but also physicians and even genetic counselors, about how we think about things when we're thinking of we're a patient versus a doctor versus a scientist. I just tell it in multiple views. I talk a lot in the book about your family and talking to your family and kind of the family politics of cancer secrecy and the psychology around that. And then also I talk a lot in the book and hope to educate people about research and how important it is. There are so many genes we don't know anything about. And so we want all of patients with cancer to have a genetic analysis in the research realm so that we can put that all together. And like you said, have this future sci-fi time where we'll just sequence your genome and we'll tell you when you need to worry about what. So it's a book to, you know, help people figure out what to do with their genetics.
No, and it is fascinating, and this is the new age now. I mean, look how far we've come. And, we can talk briefly or just touch on all these new immunotherapy protocols that are coming on, you know, mm-hmm. that you can now get sequenced, and they can run the 20,000 gene sequence now in like a day for, you know, was it $5,000 at this point? They can sequence your whole body in some places and match you up with a particular protocol that is specific to your genome. And it somehow miraculously helps your body heal.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's we're not there with that. And, you know, we have not tested whether sequencing a tumor is a standard thing to do that will, you know, improve our treatments. You know, this is still a research effort. Whether or not that's true or not is not clear. I mean, there are some things we can sequence where clearly we will. You know, if we have that mutation, we know to use drug X. But in general, we're still taking baby steps.
No, and I agree. And until we have big data and massive biobanks and public adoption and all these, it's the premise behind a lot of the moonshot philosophy, which I think is very promising. It's nice to mm-hmm. have people at least rallying around something that isn't, you know, the napalming of your body and all mm-hmm. just, you know, total total, you know, obliteration of your everything, and hopefully the good parts grow back. I think we're beyond that old school science at this point. But, you know, it's just exciting to me. The last part I want to bring up is I was, again, listening to your amazing interview with Terry Gross, and she brought up the issues of discrimination for having genetic mutations.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of, like, the X-Men movies. But besides that, you know, mm-hmm. employment is we're a young adult community. We're just getting our mm-hmm. lives together, just getting our jobs, and our resumes are out there, and we're on Facebook, and we share our social footprint. And how do we avoid the stigma and maybe not the actual HR action against discrimination of who we are in the workplace? And I didn't even know this. The Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act of 2008 does mm-hmm. a really good job. Can you talk about that?
Well, it's pretty good. It you know, it does prevent you from being, you know, if they find out that you've got a mutation, you know, you cannot be discriminated against when it comes to health insurance or employment. It leaves out some things, unfortunately. So life insurance is one of those. Although life insurance companies, a lot of them, I need to do a survey of this, but those that I've spoken to say that if you learn your mutation and you do what we recommend, you know, that what the physicians recommend you do to prevent you from getting cancer as a result of that, so you have your prophylactic surgeries, they consider you like a person who stopped smoking, which is a remarkable thing. But still, they can discriminate if they want. So the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act of 2008 is wonderful in the sense that it really does put up some barriers for your employer and your health insurer, but not for your life insurer and disability insurance.
So before we go, how are you feeling and how is your family doing?
Oh, my family is great. I was terrified that they would be worried about the book because I outed most of them. But, you know, it turned out okay. I have, I still have my family. They are not disgruntled. So my sister did die of breast cancer in her late 30s. So
I'm sorry about that.
That's a tough one. But other than that, we're doing great.
Well, Theodora Ross directs the Cancer Genetics Program at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center, author of the book A Cancer in the Family, with a foreword by Siddhartha Mukherjee. Thank you so much for sharing everything. I look forward to meeting you one day to build that sci-fi movie script.
I look forward to it too, Matthew.
All
thank
right.
you.
Thank you. Take care. All righty, and now it's time for our closing sequence.
Prepare to activate.
I hear there's rumors on the internets.
You ever seen a grown man naked?
And so, to all of you, a fond farewell.
Hooray, I'm helping.
You are a meathead.
Oh, Magoo, you've done it again.
That was so terrible, I think you gave me cancer.
Okay, folks, that's our show, the 388th episode of The Stupid Cancer Show. Never miss an episode by subscribing to the podcast on iTunes or following us on SoundCloud.
I'd like to thank our guests, Katie Campbell and Dr. Theodora Ross, for joining us on the program. Broadcasting since 2007, The Stupid Cancer Show is a production of Stupid Cancer, the largest charity comprehensively addressing young adult cancer, online at stupidcancer.org. Coming to you from the chemo deck, and on behalf of my team here at The Stupid Cancer Show, we hope you had as much fun as we did poking a stick at stupid cancer. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you right back here on the next exciting podcast of The Stupid Cancer Show. Goodbye, folks.